Hi, folks. From the World Newsroom in Boston, this is technology correspondent Clark Boyd, and this is Tech Podcast number 66. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Public Radio in Boston. You can find out more about the show at theworld.org. And of course, you can always find show notes and other links from today's podcast at worldstechpodcast.blogspot.com.
The World's Technology Podcast is sponsored by Ipswitch Incorporated, the leader in messaging, network management, and data management software for small and medium-sized businesses around the globe. Visit Ipswitch at ipswitch.com to download full-function trial versions.
Don't look, I'd like to rattle a few. You found all your sins and threw them away.
A little bit different theme music today. This is from a Scottish band called Amplifico. You're going to be hearing more about them later in the show. This is a group that's unsigned, but they don't care. They've started a blog. They're going to start a podcast. They offer a lot of their songs available via MP3 downloads. They're using technology to bypass the record companies.
It's amazing how quickly word is spreading. We're going out there and we're getting the listeners. We're getting the people ourselves. I think it's really exciting, definitely.
More about Amplifico later in the program. We're also going to be hearing about whether Chinese and other foreign nationals working in high-level scientific research in the United States may or may not be spying. For example, the United States is building a new high-tech line of naval destroyers, but so too are the Chinese.
The Chinese are known to be building a new class of destroyers which look remarkably like the American destroyers. The possibility that you come up independently of exactly the same design is rather difficult to come up with. The Europeans have not, for example, managed to do that without consulting the Americans.
And we're also going to be hearing about a new website called WatchingAmerica.com, which, after it started up, got some very interesting clientele.
Even the CIA, the State Department, the copy desk of the New York Times, the intellectuals, we had a lot of them. They came to us fast. But obviously one thing we're determined to do is push this out to the general public. We want people to be able to see this content alongside their newspapers whilst they drink their coffee.
All those stories today on the World's Technology Podcast. Okay, well, as always, we're going to jump right in. I wanted to start off with this interview that we did a few days ago on WatchingAmerica.com, which is this interesting new website which has started up. And basically, it posts stories about America that appear in foreign news media, and they're translated when necessary. And one of the hosts of our show, Ken Bader, did an interview with Robin Kerner, who is one of the founders and managers of the website. And so I wanted to play that interview for you. And Robin Kerner from WatchingAmerica.com started out by explaining why he and his partners launched the site in the first place.
Well, the short answer is, I guess it was an idea whose time had come. I have been living on and off in the United States for about 3 or 4 years and was intrigued and interested by the growing introspection that has been in this country since 9/11. A lot of books appearing in bookshops, you know, with those titles of, you know, why do they hate us, all this kind of thing. But there didn't seem to be an equivalent in the daily media.
Now, who is looking at this website?
Well, that's a good question. One thing that's been very interesting for us since we started this earlier on in the year is that our audience very quickly was the elites. You know, even the CIA, the State Department, the copy desk of the New York Times, the intellectuals, we had a lot of them. They came to us fast. But obviously one thing we're determined to do is push this out to the general public. We want people to be able to see this content alongside their newspapers whilst they drink their coffee.
Now, what do you tell your audience about the newspapers that they're reading on your website?
We actually don't make any claims about any of the publications that we draw from. One of the reasons is that we actually draw from literally hundreds of newspapers all over the world, covering pretty much every country. So that would be a Herculean task.
Might it not be helpful for some of the readers of your website to be informed that some of the newspapers they're looking at are state-controlled and some are from a free press?
you know, anybody who wants to find out can easily find that information out with a Google search. We are actually compiling some of this information. But to get it compiled consistently, as I say, for all the publications that we handle, is going to take a long time.
We should mention, Mr. Kerner, that there's not only press material on your website, but there's broadcast material. And one clip today is of a demonstration in the West Bank, and this aired on Al Jazeera. Let's listen.
George Bush, bala ihsas!
George Bush, bala ihsas!
George Bush!
Now, those protesters were chanting in Arabic, and what they were saying was, George Bush has no feelings, and they go on to say he should collapse and be trampled on. Now, here's what's kind of surprising. The demonstrators were the TV staff of the Ramallah office of Al Jazeera TV. Now, I saw today in a poll that was just released today that viewers in six Arab countries called Al Jazeera the most popular TV network for international news in that part of the world. So my question for you is, what's the view of America in the stories from Al Jazeera that you've posted?
You know, obviously, most of the content that's written globally about the United States right now is negative. It's particularly negative about the administration. I would say that only around 5 to 10% is overtly positive, and we actually have to work harder to find that material, and we do work harder to find that material because we don't want to push a particular political point of view. We do want to capture the entire range of opinions and views about the United States. Obviously, Al Jazeera, like any other large media company or corporation, delivers to some extent what its audience wants. That's how they make money. And if you look at the Al Jazeera content, like the content or any of the other content on our site, you will learn probably more about the people making and delivering and writing the content than about what is being written.
Now, one of the top stories this week was President Bush's speech on Iraq. How was that speech received in the world press?
We have something up there from Saudi Arabia, the Arab News. They noticed that a softening of tone, and they put that down to domestic pressure. You know, all politics is local and such like. Actually, quite a not at all rabid response to the speech. The French are even more cynical. We have something up from Libération, Le Monde. The piece from Libération, you know, is actually quite harsh. They're accusing Bush of engaging in historical revisionism at the same time as he claims that his opponents have been doing so. I would say cynicism, but, you know, I urge your listeners to just go and look for themselves.
Robin Kerner publishes the website watchingamerica.com. Robin, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I will, of course, put a link up to that on our blog, worldstechpodcast.blogspot.com, but, you know, it's pretty easy to figure it out, watchingamerica.com. So there you go. Okay, I wanted to switch now to this the spying story. This is a piece that ran on the BBC as part of their analysis program, and I wanted to include this in the tech podcast because we're talking about high-level scientific research here in the States. We're talking about people who work in the technology field, in the science field, in the hard academic research fields. So here's the piece from the BBC.
America wants to restrict the ability of Chinese and other foreign nationals from working in high-level scientific research in the US. They worry that some of those involved in businesses and universities are in fact acting as spies for their homeland. But the plan is generating fierce opposition at home and abroad. In today's analysis, Vanessa Heaney asks how great the threat of espionage is and whether these proposals will ultimately damage America's scientific and business interests.
Recently, they've identified as many as 3,500 front companies that are involved in espionage for the People's Republic of China. And just in the last couple of weeks here in the United States, there is a significant espionage case in California where a group of people were found to be exporting American military secrets.
Peter Brooks of the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank in Washington, he says the FBI considers China to be the greatest counterintelligence problem of the next decade.
In addition, the FBI also says that Chinese espionage cases are rising 20 to 30% every year in Silicon Valley alone.
Spying is one of the oldest professions. If the Chinese are trying to steal industrial military technologies from the Americans, that is hardly news. If the Chinese have something to offer, I'm sure the Americans will try to steal from them too.
Dr. Steve Tsang, a fellow in modern Chinese studies at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. But although spying is an old problem, the US government now wants new ways of blocking Chinese espionage. In 1999, Congress issued a report which asserted there is a long-standing campaign by China to acquire sensitive technologies in order to counter U.S. military capabilities in the Western Pacific. At the moment, America regulates the export of certain advanced technology to countries perceived as a threat, such as China, Iran, and North Korea. And citizens from those countries must be licensed if they want to work with such sensitive information.
If a company or a research lab or a university based in the United States wants to use a non-U.S. citizen to work on technology that would otherwise be export controlled if it was going to be shipped to that person's country of citizenship, then that company or research lab or university has to apply for what's called a deemed export license to allow that foreign national to use that equipment or technology in the United States.
James Mulvenon, director of the Center for Research and Analysis, a think tank in Washington, D.C. He says some people have been getting around this.
There is a perception bolstered by a great deal of empirical evidence that a number of Chinese nationals were getting citizenship in the United Kingdom and in Canada and other places deemed less sensitive and getting access to export-controlled technology that had serious military implications.
This problem was highlighted in a report last year issued by the Inspector General of the U.S. Commerce Department. It was called Deemed Export Controls May Not Stop the Transfer of Sensitive Technology to Foreign Nationals in the U.S. In it, the Inspector General criticized loopholes in the current system and recommended changes.
The proposal was that they were going to change the deemed export regulatory process to be not based on a person's country of citizenship, but on the country of birth, so that they could track those people from countries that we were carefully monitoring for export controls who had gotten citizenship subsequently in countries that were not as sensitive for export controls.
And this proposal and others are currently at the center of a serious national debate in the U.S. The exact details of the measures and what areas of research and development they would cover are still being worked out by the Bureau of Industry and Security in the US. When asked for an interview, the Bureau told Analysis it wasn't willing to discuss the details of any proposals. But whatever emerges, China feels its citizens are being vilified. Its Washington embassy gave Analysis this statement.
The majority of Chinese students and scholars in the United States abide by U.S. laws, work hard, and have made positive contributions to the progress of science and technology of the United States and world at large. The U.S. proposal of an expansion of deemed exports is a kind of discrimination against foreign students and scholars, including those from China, which will not benefit exchanges in fields of science, technology, culture, and education among countries.
So what is the evidence that China is spying on the U.S.? China now has the world's third largest defense budget. It's building up its forces using advanced weapons technology, which Dr. Stephen Tsang says looks remarkably familiar.
How the Chinese actually get hold of those technologies, we do not know for certain. The Americans suspect that it was espionage. An example of a very advanced weapon system that the Americans have is the so-called Aegis-equipped Ali-Burke-class destroyer. What it essentially is a very advanced air defense battle management system. The Chinese are known to be building a new class of destroyers which look remarkably like the American destroyers. The possibility that you come up independently of exactly the same design is rather difficult to come up with. The Europeans have not, for example, managed to do that without consulting the Americans.
The most recent high-profile case of Chinese espionage in the United States involved a Chinese woman called Katrina Leung. She was the centerpiece of a U.S. counterintelligence plan to tackle Chinese espionage. According to John Pike of the consultancy group GlobalSecurity.org, Ms. Leung was considered an asset to the FBI.
And then, lo and behold, it turned out that she had not been working for America. She had been working for China. They've had a very hard time prosecuting her. The case was thrown out of court earlier this year, but I think that they went back and decided that a lot of the investigations that they had had of Chinese intelligence over the last 15 years that she had been working with the U.S. government, that maybe some of those cases had been bad, maybe that she had been steering the American investigators in the wrong direction.
So clearly, there have been instances of Chinese espionage in the U.S., but many believe that the U.S. response is an overreaction. Edmund Rice chairs a lobby group of technology and telecoms companies in Washington.
The U.S. security concerns, which in certain respects are legitimate, ought to be more narrowly targeted to prevent harmful transfer technology and not get in the way of ordinary Chinese students and business people coming to the U.S. So it's really, in our view, using a sledgehammer where a much more targeted enforcement effort is necessary.
James Mulvenon from the Center for Research and Analysis agrees.
I do feel that in the balance that the current regulation as designed will throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that there is a compromise position, which is what I think the Commerce Department is currently looking for, given the vociferousness and volume of the responses to its proposed change that it's received from universities and companies, that they're going to try and find a sensible middle ground. I think I'm more comfortable with that middle ground, which seeks to close some elements of the loophole, but not to shut the door entirely.
Throughout the consultation process, universities and academic institutions have been invited to comment.
I think it's just going to be a disaster for the universities, both in terms of the numbers and, of course, the effect it has on a population which is, to some extent, already been dissuaded from coming to the U.S. because of new visa rules and so forth that have been brought in since 2001.
Physics professor Simon Sordi from the University of Chicago. He's one of hundreds of academics who have written letters voicing concerns about the proposals. He says there are around 60,000 Chinese students in the U.S., many of whom play a vital role in research and development.
I'm in the Enrico Fermi Institute here in Chicago. Enrico Fermi, of course, came to the U.S. during the Second World War and was instrumental in developing the ideas for the first atomic bomb. Now, at the time, he was Italian. And in fact, we were at war with Italy then from the U.S., so he would have certainly not been allowed to work on any of that stuff. So you could make the statement that, well, if this rule had been in force in the 1940s and 50s, then the U.S. would never have become a nuclear power.
It's not just in academia that foreign nationals are playing a significant role. Businesses are lobbying hard against these proposals. Edmund Rice says the companies in his lobby group are worried that these proposals would delay business plans and significantly impede the sale of U.S. technology abroad.
China is now a major producer of computer chips. They buy U.S. computer chip-making equipment. They're involved in research and development on software. Under this proposal, most Chinese nationals could not obtain access to either U.S. corporate or academic programs in these areas without first getting a U.S. government license. And that could significantly impede the integration of United States technology companies into the Chinese economy.
If relations sour between the U.S. and China, there will be global consequences too. Matthew Sherwood is with the Business Research Group, the Economist Intelligence Unit.
They are the drivers of the world economy, and China depends on the U.S. for an export market, and the U.S. relies on China for financing its large trade deficits. Companies often have their R&D spread throughout the world. So a U.S. company may do some of its R&D in the U.S., but it also sends a lot of that R&D to Asia, Eastern Europe, and then brings it back. Well, what this legislation would do is limit the ability of those companies to that sort of activity. At the very least, it means a lot more paperwork, having to apply for a license for every bit of R&D work of this nature. Or you might just find that certain companies will just have to do this all overseas and not be exporting anything from the U.S.
So, is it worth potentially losing out on valuable scientific research and business contracts in order to try to prevent industrial secrets from ending up in the wrong hands? That's a question for Peter Brooks at the Heritage Foundation.
Absolutely. I mean, if you don't have your national security, you have nothing, and that was not having your national security will have a tremendous effect on your economy and on your well-being.
and losing research and development because so many foreign students are crucial to this?
If you're talking just about China, but there are a number of other foreign students that come to the United States as well, such as places like as India. So it doesn't mean if you have a counterintelligence threat from one country and you don't have it from another, it seems logical to me that you would use students from a particular country where there isn't that counter-espionage or counterintelligence threat.
The U.S. Commerce Department might hope to block espionage by limiting the number of workers with a Chinese background in the U.S. But what's to stop China from recruiting other foreign nationals to do their spying for them, or simply getting the technology from elsewhere? James Malvellin.
In almost all cases, the Chinese could simply turn to the Germans or the Japanese or the Koreans or the French or somebody else and get almost identical. There's very few technologies that are so unique to U.S. Industry or the R&D community that you couldn't get access in the global economy.
Before the U.S. publishes its proposals, which are expected in the next few months, it clearly has a fight on its hands. It has to convince academics, business people and others that hindering their work is a price worth paying in order to try to keep America's secrets safe.
The final piece of the puzzle today is a piece that I did for our program on this Scottish band called Amplifico. And you may be wondering why the technology correspondent is doing music pieces for the show, but you know that I've done them before. Okay, first of all, I have other interests outside of technology. Shock, alarm, I know. Every once in a while, I like to do one of these music pieces, especially if it's music that I like. And in this case, I really, really like this band. But there is a technology angle here, so it's not that much of a stretch. I heard about Amplifico because I've been listening to the Tartan podcast, which is done by Mark Hunter in Glasgow. And Mark basically started a podcast a while back and said, I'm going to feature unsigned, independent Scottish bands that need the exposure and should have the exposure. And Amplifico turned up on there, and I'm listening to the podcast, and I'm thinking, oh, man, this is perfect. This is a perfect global hit. That's the name of the segment for our program where we, you know, highlight really great music from around the world. So I got in touch with the band and did an interview and got some of their music and, you know, and mixed this piece together. So here's the piece on Scotland's Amplifico.
Here's a recipe for success on the Scottish music scene. Start with four friends from Fife, near Edinburgh, who've been playing music together since they were 13 years old. Form a band and give it a slightly obscure name. Now, stick a bunch of recording equipment in the band members' bedrooms. Let them play, mix it all together, then release the results.
Here and I want to be, and I don't want to force it. Going to myself for more and picking out the best bits. You mark my words, yeah.
The British media have been using adjectives like gorgeous, haunting, sizzling to describe Amplifico's music. For better or worse, they've not used that overused word eclectic, but that's a good description of Amplifico's sound. And lead singer and pianist Donna Machocha says it's a good description of her influences.
When people ask me what my favorite music is, my mind goes blank because literally my CD collection is so varied. I'm a big fan of Rachmaninoff, a classical pianist, and jazz, Ella Fitzgerald, I could list so many.
Get the stuff together, stand you, wait, we come clean. Fever's like a big block of hard clay with just a few weak fingerprints.
Donna Machocha acknowledges that hers is not a typical Scottish surname. Her great-great-grandfather and his family left Italy for Scotland in the late 1800s. She credits her piano playing skills to her Italian grandfather, certainly not to her first piano teacher.
I was dragged kicking and screaming to piano lessons from an early age, from about the age of 8 or 9. I absolutely hated it. Every Friday afternoon, I had to go down to this piano teacher. He wasn't the best because I remember one time I turned round in the middle of a lesson after, you know, finishing a piece, and there was silence. He never said anything, and I turned round and he was asleep in his chair. So I think, and he used to smoke a lot in the house as well, so I really hated piano lessons.
Machocha eventually did find a piano teacher she liked. She also found bassist Brett Allen, guitarist Ross Kilgore, and drummer Dave Brunton. The four played together a few years back in another band. Then, they went their separate ways for a couple of years. Donna Machocha spent a lot of time writing songs and testing out her singing voice. She got back in touch with the guys and demoed a song she'd written.
Actually, the first song that I ever played to the boys was a song called All Your Sins. I was so nervous because I'd never done anything like this before, and I was absolutely shaking. My voice was shaking, and I sang All Your Sins, and the rest is history, really. The boys latched onto it, and we decided to make a proper go of this new project.
I've been sure the picture we shaking vacant place was there into submission. I'll dig in these ladies, the compromising every detail just to be gonna all our lights in the flicker of the screen. I think I suffer, only time will tell. Don't look, I'd like to rattle a few. You found all your sins and threw them away. You found all your sins and threw them away.
Amplifico's been at it for nearly 2 years. The band hasn't been signed to a label yet, but they're not waiting around for record executives. Instead, Amplifico's embracing technology to spread the word about its music. Amplifico's website, for example, features a blog where band members communicate with fans, and fans can find copies of the group's songs. Donna Machocha says that Amplifico's online presence has given the band a global fan base.
It's amazing how quickly word is spreading. We're going out there and we're getting the listeners, we're getting the people ourselves. I think it's really exciting, definitely.
Amplifico's also hard at work on a new album. This time, the band's decided to forego the bedroom recording setups in favor of a studio. For The World, this is Clark Boyd.
I like the chemistry of chemicals when we think when apart. So far away and so unknown, and you don't know me at all.
I mentioned there at the end some of the great online stuff that Amplifico is doing on their website. That's Amplifico, AmplifiCo.net. You know, do go up and check that out. There's even more up there than what I was able to mention in the piece. They're not only blogging, they're also going to start their own podcast. They also have a lot of their songs available via MP3 for download. They're also doing this great thing, and I love this. They're putting up a lot of raw and kind of unmixed stuff. So you're really getting to hear the music as it's being produced, as it's being developed, and you get to sort of track it from raw material to finished product. And I think that's really great. And they welcome feedback. And they also have a place up there where they say get in touch with them if you want to remix some of their stuff. They're happy to talk to you about doing that. So I just think that that's really cool. And my favorite part of this puzzle is, you know, here you're talking about this new medium, sort of podcasting, making things available via MP3. And I just love the creative ways that bands are starting to use that. So that's why I wanted to feature them. I just wanted to also mention this great little note that the New Oxford American Dictionary has said that the word podcast has been declared Word of the Year. So there you go. It was supposed to be included last year, but they didn't feel that use of the word had caught up with the actual use of the technology. This year they do, and so podcast is the word of the year. Then there were other words that didn't make it that are popular in tech circles. One was life hack, which refers to a more efficient way of completing an everyday task. If any of you have a good life hack that you'd like to share with me, the email is Clark, C-L-A-R-K, dot Boyd, B-O-Y-D, at bbc.co.uk. Another word that they thought about including but didn't was rootkit, which is defined as software installed on a computer by someone other than the owner intended to conceal other programs or processes, files, or system data. You probably heard it recently because it hit headlines when Sony was found to have included a rootkit as part of the copy protection system on some of its music CDs. Other words that did not make the cut included bird flu, Sudoku, and trans fat. So there you go. Before I sign off today, I just want to remind you that The World is now podcasting its global hit every day, and it's also podcasting its geo quiz. If you want to find out more about how you can subscribe to those podcasts, you can go to our website, theworld.org. I also put links up on the blog, worldstechpodcast.blogspot.com. Okay, so that's it for podcast number 66 in Boston. This is technology correspondent Clark Boyd saying we'll be back again real soon.
And I move my hand and you get a wave, and I get that little bit higher, just in about that understanding your language, to the beat of the stress of imperfection. Your pain attracts me, nothing seems to make sense. I want to see your mind.